Hello and welcome. This is Janae Libby, and you have reached episode 62 of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. How are you doing, guys? Today's show is sponsored by Teege FM, that is T-E-E-J-F-M, a brand new community podcast network bringing together folks in our community like me and students at UVA, created by WTJU. Learn more at teege.fm. And listeners like you who have sponsored this podcast through Patreon, learn more at patreon.com/audaciouspod. Let's get this thing going, shall we? Hello again. Hello and welcome to Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. Yeah, I could probably do some work on that initial introduction of our new sponsor, Teege FM. I'll work on it. I kind of just winged it this time. Probably not a good idea to wing your brand new sponsor's announcement. But I do thank Teege FM. Yes, I am a brand new podcaster with their network. WTJU has created this fabulous new podcast network, bringing together local podcasters, whether they be students just learning or folks in our community who have been podcasting for a while. And I am proud to say that I am the first community that they have welcomed into their fold. I'll be able to use their studios now, so there will be roundtables in the future, podcast roundtables. I'm going to learn how to use the boards. That means good audio in your ears. Still really loving my new recorder and wondering why it took me so damn long to get one. Does it sound good? I hope so. Welcome to Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. Who's this lady rambling in your ear? Well, I am Janae Libby. I'm a writer who started a podcast, and that podcast has become its own monster, which I'm very excited about. My purpose here is connection. I want to talk with, rather than about, folks online. I want to focus on the food work. Get the focus away from the pretty plate on Instagram and back to the people, all the people who labor in our kitchens, field stores, and boardrooms, people who are audacious about what they do. And today's interview fits that bill perfectly. I will be speaking with Chef Todd Grieger, who works on teaching cooking at Culinard in Richmond. And I was so excited to finally sit down with an educator. Now, we have chefs who teach cooking around town, different classes here and there, but Chef Todd Grieger, that's all he does. That's all he does. He teaches cooking. He is in between cooking jobs. He has cooked in almost every restaurant here in Charlottesville for the past 20 years, and he's taking time out to reevaluate and reflect, and we talk a lot about that in the interview. What does success mean? And how does maybe your definition of success not fit in with the cultural definition of success and everybody else's expectations for you? It's a great conversation. I cannot wait for you to hear it. Remember, you can find me at iTunes. My website is audacious.co. And I always start these podcasts out by talking just a little bit about what's on my mind. Right now, I'm very excited about the Teege FM partnership. WTJU will be having a Soup There It Is soup competition to benefit the station at the Fry Spring Beach Club on Sunday the 26th at 12:30. I will be a judge. It may be my last judging event because I am looking 50 in the face. I'll be turning 50 next month, but don't tell anybody. And my tummy ain't what it used to be, but I think I can handle some soup. And this seems like a poetic way to go out with a new partnership. One last judging duty. So a beginning and an ending for me on the 26th. Come out and help me judge some soup to benefit WTJU. Also very excited about the JBF Award nominations, which just came out today. They announced the semifinalists. And I'm very proud to say that three semifinalists have been on this very podcast. Chef Ian Bowden of The Shack was interviewed. such a good interview. It's episode 31. I know that from my heart because it was such a great talk. Diane Flint of Foggy Ridge Cider, and you know her, you love her, A Chef's Life, Vivian Howard, her book Deep Run Roots. I caught her while she was on her book tour. Congratulations to those three nominees of the James Beard Awards, the Chef Restaurant Edition. These are semifinalists. They will be announcing the finalists on March 15th. And I have a feeling all three of these great folks will make it through because they are excellent and audacious about what they do. The Virginia Book Fest is coming March 22nd and through the 26th. I will be moderating and podcasting that event. And Chef Ashley Christensen of Poole's Diner is also a James Beard semifinalist. She will be speaking at the Book Fest. So there's a fourth one. I'm hoping to talk with her. Still working out the details. So I might have four semifinalists on this podcast for all you know. Look for that March 22nd to the 26th. And the biggest thing on my mind right now, barring all of those excellent, great events and things happening in my life, I went to see my best friend on Sunday. And if you've been following the podcast for the past few months, you know my best friend Scotty Nichols has colorectal cancer. He has worked as a concierge in Washington, D.C., most recently at the Omni on Capitol Hill. And the hospitality industry does not have great health insurance. There's no great health insurance anywhere, but it's particularly hard if you work in restaurants or in hotels or anywhere where you're making sure that folks have a great stay or a great meal. I have a GoFundMe, and I've been sharing the hell out of it. And I want to thank a few people that have stepped forward because I have created levels. If you donate $100, I will give you a shout out on the podcast for your business. If you donate $500, I will give you a shout out on 6 episodes. That's 3 months worth of podcasting, 6 episodes worth of free advertising for your business, and you will help make an extraordinary human being able to focus on his healing rather than on the bills that are piling up and whether he's going to be able to keep a roof over his head. And yes, it is that desperate right now. And I visited with him on Sunday. And driving home, Joni Mitchell was actually on WTJU. I was listening to them driving home, and the moon was full, and this sense of love came over me that was so strange because it felt like happy and sad had intertwined. It was this round, marble-esque feeling, and it was so pure and whole. I was so happy and grateful that I'd been able to spend a day with my friend. I took him out to eat. We had a long talk, as we always do. We laughed, as we always do. We shared old pictures, as we always do. I always seem to dig more out the more I look. And it was such a pure feeling of love, but it was tinged with some sadness, too. I kept picturing this clear marble of love with maybe a little blue-gray cloud floating through it, like a marble you might play with as a child. And I was so filled with gratitude, but I was so filled with poignant sorrow and wistfulness and wishing because I really don't want him to be sick. And I want him to be able to heal and be well and be back at 100% and back at the person that he once was. And I want to thank these folks for stepping forward and donating to this cause. I will have the link in the show notes, as I always do. And thank you so much to Jeanne Frey from Treat Yourself Right Massage. Not only did she donate money, but she also donated a gift certificate that we used to increase donations. And I've since learned that that's not quite kosher, so we won't be doing that anymore, but I didn't know, so, you know, mea culpa. Thank you, Jeanne. Please check her out. I use her myself when I need a massage. I'm hoping to get one for my 50th birthday so I can work through it. She does pressure point. She's fantastic. Treat Yourself Right Massage. Also want to thank Laurie Chapman Blakey of Pearl's Cupcake Shop. Laurie, thank you so much for your generous donation. Pearl's is right here in Charlottesville, Virginia. Also want to thank Chef Angelo Vangelopoulos, Wow, I said that right. At the Ivy Inn, who stepped forward with a very generous donation, thank you to Chef Vangelopoulos. You are a star, a rock star, and a gem, and so freaking generous and kind, and I love you so much. Also want to give a shout out to Steve Henry. He is someone that I've gotten to know on Facebook. He is a scream. He is so funny. And he owns Gregory Henry Landscapes, Inc. in Houston, Texas. So if you're listening in Houston and you need your yard worked on, this guy is a master. And he will talk your ear off and he will make you laugh. And he's very easy on the eyes. So give Steve Henry a call. And last but not least, thank you. Thank you so much to dear friend and business owner, Chris Carlson of Burlap and Board in Chattanooga, Tennessee, who stepped forward with a very generous donation as well. Thank you to all of those folks who donated to the Scotty Nichols Cancer Fund. Yes, I'm being obnoxious, but if it was your best friend, you would be too. We need to make sure that he heals and focuses on healing and not on bills. Thank you so much. Okay, today's episode is sponsored by Teej FM. Learn more about this great new community collaborative initiative. Is that a thing? Community collaborative initiative. Teej.fm, Teej.fm. And thanks also to our sponsors, listeners like you who put forth a little bit of money every month at patreon.com to make sure that this podcast stays audacious. Learn more at patreon.com/audaciouspod. And if you're interested in a larger sponsorship where your business name appears every episode, ask me for a press kit because I do have those. All right, today's interview is with Chef Todd Grieger of Culinard Cooking School in Richmond. You know, this was my first interview of the year, 2017. I have a feeling that when 2017 ends, this one is going to end up on the best of, because I walked out feeling really good about it. We went deep, guys. And when a conversation goes deep and it only takes an hour, I left feeling like I really know this guy and I had made a new friend. And that's always a good feeling. So enjoy. Start this off. Jeff Dion is the gentleman who suggested that I talk with you, and when he did, I may have squealed because I was like, "You know, Todd, where is he? Where did he go?" I love your food at Red Pomp.
Thank you.
And you kind of fell off the radar a little bit as far as Charlottesville goes, or at least as far as I know. And I read all the things that come out and talk with people. And so when Jeff mentioned you, I was thrilled because I feel there, I'm not the only one. I think people miss you.
Well, thank you. That's nice to hear. It's nice to be missed. I was a bit burned out after Red Pump and, was evaluating what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I took a teaching position in Richmond, at the Culinard School at the Virginia College. Been doing
great.
That for the last couple years. This semester, I'm probably picked up hours at Oakhart Social.
So oh, nice.
I'm working down there.
Cool.
Working with Tristan and still doing part-time teaching.
Yeah.
But maybe back in the scene in Charlottesville soon. Don't know.
Yeah.
Always doing work with Craig and my wife. So, you know, out at the barbecue exchange here and there. But
yeah,
it's glad to be missed.
Yeah, it's good. It's like, oh, people are still asking about me. That's good.
That's good. I'm still relevant, I guess. Does that count?
You know? Okay, exactly.
Good. Actually, thank
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
Appreciate you asking.
Sure, sure. What about, because you've worked in Charlottesville restaurants for 2 decades.
True, I have.
How, when you went to teaching, how was that a challenge? Did you have to put on a different hat and become a different person?
That's a good question. It's different. It's a different client.
Yeah.
You know, you're not selling food.
Yeah.
And you have to have, it gets you patience. So it's going to make you a better chef one way or the other. You know, it's not demanding in the sense of expectations that you put on yourself.
Right.
Per se, as it comes to a result, but
right,
you know, being able to find something good in something, even though something's not that good.
Right. Right.
Is challenging. And also, you know, being able to motivate a student that you don't pay is, you know, is challenging sometimes too. The school I work in is, I look at it as a secondary education school. It's not like CIA or New England Culinary or Johnson and Wales. You know, it's a lot of people repurposing their lives.
Oh.
A lot of ex-military people wanted to change in their lives. I do have people right out of high school, but you know, it's an eclectic mix of people.
Oh,
and,
nice.
You know, some of them, you know, aren't quite used to the rigors of the restaurant business and then, you know, how demanding it can be. So, you know, there's a lot of attrition.
Sure. But, I was wondering about that, the age range of your students and if some of them were right out of school or because there are a lot of people using cooking in restaurants as a second career.
Yeah, and have, I think, unrealistic expectations about the business, too, to boot. I think the average age would probably be, I'd say 33 would probably be the average age. I've had some of the best students I've had have been in their 50s that have come in and that have sort of settled into their lives, obviously. One lady named Hortensia, who strikes, you know, my memory, was in the military for 25 years and got out. She was a welder. Hard worker, used to hard work, liked the regimen of the military, liked the structure, you know, would fit very well into a restaurant, you know, sort of structure. But then you have some people that are, you know, been, you know, sitting at home for 20 years and they want to do something different.
Sure.
And it's admirable they go to school.
Yeah.
But maybe the restaurant track, maybe not the right one for them in their mid 40s, you know, so, and have a bit of unrealistic expectations on what the hours pay demanding stuff like that would be coming right out of school.
See, I'm thinking military training, that's a direct, I mean, that would be a good background to have to go into restaurants.
Yeah. I had a guy named Ashanti who, you know, has PTSD, got out of, served in two tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan, got out. It was in the Rangers.
Oh my God.
You know, got money to go to school from the government, which is great. Great student, A student, you know, probably, you know, because of his disability couldn't make it, you know, with a lot of like pressure, you know, but wanted to learn and continue to grow as a person and started his own sort of business working for his church, you know? So there's a lot of good stories in there, you know, with people and their expectations they have. And I think that's what I've gotten out of it the most is that I, that it's not like a business where I have to motivate and get people to do things, that they don't normally want to do sometimes by a stick.
You
know, and then
these dishes need washed, go do it.
Right. Oh. You know, there's a good, you know, there's a lot of qualified, talented cooks, every city, you know, I'd say 50% of the workforce just does enough not to get fired. So you have to kind of you know, you kind of have to motivate that the student that comes there, you know, like I'd say 2 out of 10 or 2 out of 15 are going to be really productive in their field. And I focus, you know, I give everybody this, you know, the same, leeway, but you know, you try to find those people that are going to go far and kind of encourage them to be good.
That's so funny. I used to be a teacher and I could tell that 2 out of 10. How do you do that? Like what reveals itself to you in the classroom where you can say, oh yeah, that person can.
I look for work ethic first, you know, and foremost commitment, you know, I mean, are you willing to do the things, the details, you know, and then that's business and professional life in general, you know, like talent is not good enough. You know, you have to be able to, you know, you have to show up to work on time. You have to do the jobs presented to you. You have to have a good attitude. You have to try to make the people around you better. You know, you have to, you know, understand your role in whatever the system is. And, you know, and people, you know, if you don't show up to class on time and you don't do your homework and you don't, you know, you don't do those things. Yeah. And you're unwilling to do the things that are asked of you and, you know, be precision with knife work, working clean, you know, labeling things, you know, these types of things that chefs kind of look at right when you walk in the door, they don't do that. And they're, you know, so, you know, and you kind of have to turn that off because everybody gets the same shake, you know, you have to be fair to everybody, but like, you know, but some people you can see that kind of takes to the details first and then talent kind of comes into that in my estimation, you know?
So can cooking professionally, can it be taught to the point where because I hear this about acting, like, oh, you can learn how to act, but unless you have that innate talent, you're never going to be great.
I don't think work ethic can be taught.
Yeah.
I think that it has to, you can set an example and people can emulate you.
Yeah.
Okay. Or it can be inside of you.
You
but
either
if you're
have
lazy,
it or you don't.
You're just lazy.
Right.
You know, I look at it, take it to myself as far as like making personal changes in your life. Like for me, I've been sober for 12 years. Like
yeah.
I had to want to do it and change everything about my life to get to that point to make myself sober. I couldn't just do half of it. It wasn't like
right.
a buffet where I can go take a piece of yeah. that, a piece of that.
I'll be sober today, but not tomorrow.
Right. You know, so work
yeah.
ethics like that, you know,
gotcha.
You kind of have to do all the details to do that.
Sure.
You know, and that's something like Christian Kelly taught me that really well, when, you know, about 10 years ago when I was working with him that,
yeah.
you know, like it's, you know, cooking is a craft. Anybody can do it. You can teach mm-hmm. people to do it. Now there's lots of elements of art to craft, you know? And so, you know, when you start talking about being a good food artist, you know, when you start talking about mm-hmm. plating and creativity, you know, you have to be able to master a foundation before you're able to, you know, put that in an applicable way on your plate so that it's
right.
cohesive and makes sense.
Right. Right.
So teaching foundation and, you know, like not to be too many cliches, but you know, like you have to learn to crawl before you can learn to walk.
Sure.
You have to do all that stuff. So
sure.
teaching people how to be on time, you know, like, and so, you know,
the,
like
do the grunt work, do all the stuff that makes a restaurant.
I just had a student call, email me today. I'm going to have a food, you know, I'm doing a food test for catering at Mosaic in Richmond.
Oh, nice.
And she's like, I'm nervous. And I was just like, look, you know, nobody expect you're not on Top Chef. Like, you know, like go in there, work,
no
your chef's looking to how clean you work, how organized sure. you are, how good of your attitude you are. You know, they're not expecting you to go in there to be, take his job. You know, mm-hmm. he wants you to see like, you know, do you have the tools necessary to do that? And that's culinary school is for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
I hear that so often from, people that run restaurants that, I don't know if it's a generational thing. Like they hire folks and the kids get in there and they're like, yeah, well, I don't want to wash dishes. I want to, you know, get behind the line and do what you do. And
well, and they don't understand the long view, you know,
yeah.
like if you're a chef and I had to learn this, you know, like it's just not good enough to be able to make good food.
Yeah.
You know, you have to, people have to buy into you,
yeah.
you know, you have to buy into your system.
Yeah.
You have to buy into how you treat people. And you know, you have to, that's a learning process as you go forward, you know, developing your management style and who you are. You know, I'm still doing that to this day, you
mm-hmm.
know, like Red Pump was a huge lesson for me that I had to learn, you know, so, you know, like washing dishes and doing every job in the restaurant, people need to see that.
Yeah.
So that when you ask them to do something that's unpleasant and crappy, they're going to go do that. And because you do that,
yeah,
you know, because nobody wants to scrub fryers. I mean, you're crazy if you want to do that, you know,
right.
but like, but you know, if it's part of your job, and, you know, like it has to get done and you need to do it as well as you cut carrots.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
And so that's part of that. So,
sure.
And, you know, culinary school is great for that. It's not the only way for that, but it's a good way.
Exactly. Exactly. And you mentioned Christian Kelly over at Maya.
Yep.
Would you consider him a mentor?
He would be my mentor in life. Absolutely. Like,
huh. Oh, I need one of those. I need a life mentor.
To formulate this the right way. Like when I went to work at Maya, you know, he really was like, here, you know, I want you to kind of find your way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was my first sponsor in AA. I hope I'm not breaking his anonymity here, but like, he's pretty vocal about that. But, you know, he really taught me what it was to be a professional.
Hmm.
And have to have a life that's not the same as everybody else's life. So in the restaurant business and, you know, to be an individual and to allow me to be creative and,
that's nice. Not to conform to anyone's idea.
He had a vision
success.
For his restaurant and, you know, I had to stay within the parameters of what
sure.
he wanted. And
sure.
I sometimes strayed out that direction a bit and he would come back in and gently kind of nudge me back in the right direction. But, you know, he really taught me how to survive, you know, being criticized, you know, having negativity,
mm-hmm.
you know, being positive about yourself, you know,
mm-hmm.
he taught me how to be, alcohol free really, you know,
mm-hmm.
and how to continue that life in the kitchen, which is
yeah.
a difficult one.
Yeah.
And, really in how to have, you know, perspective and an attitude, you know, that's conducive. And, he, you know, when I, you know, I was very much, I don't really care what my employee's opinion was. You just do what I say when I showed up there. And then, you know, when
yeah.
I got out of there, it was definitely tempered about, you know, being more respectful and mindful of people's feelings.
Right.
Now I'm sort of a blend between the two, I think. But like, you know, he really helped to solidify my life and I'm indebted to him. you know, as a friend and as a contemporary, I guess, if you want to think of it
right.
that way. I wish I could cook as good as Christian.
His food's I need to get him on the podcast because
he got done with fine dining. He was over it.
Yeah.
And then he opened mine so he could kind of just cook delicious food. And that's
sure.
all he wanted to do.
Sure.
You know? And so he's, you know, one of the best technically proficient chefs I know. And he's very creative.
Yeah.
Awesome.
No kidding. Mm-hmm. No kidding. And you're born and raised in Charlottesville.
I was.
Yeah. And kind of cooked your way up.
Well, my mom and my dad divorced when I was very young. And I went to live with my mom in Williamsburg and then Virginia Beach. I moved back to Charlottesville in my teens and went to high school here, Albemarle High School. I was in the front of the house, actually, until my late 20s.
Whoa.
And then got into cooking because I kind of was like...
How did that happen?
I don't 100% know, to be honest with you.
You looked up one day and went, hey, I'm in the kitchen.
You know, I always thought I wanted to cook.
Yeah.
You know, I regret not. I mean, I had several opportunities to go to culinary school. I didn't go. I got accepted to CIA twice, and both times I never went because of jobs. But... which was silly, but I'm glad I didn't because I mm-hmm. had my own path at the same
yeah.
time. But I do regret as an adult at 43 now, excuse me, just turned 43, not having a degree, you know, like having a degree from college, kind of like, you know, that'd been okay to have that, you know?
Oh, there's so many paths to that.
There are, true. I don't look at it as a regret. I look at it more as like, maybe an alternate reality that could have
yeah.
come to fruition somehow or something like
yeah.
that.
I'm convinced that you end up where you're supposed to, no matter the choices you make. So like, even if you had gone to culinary school,
that could have been it.
You'll be teaching at Culinart here at 43.
I mean, if you have a toolbox and you have tools and
yeah.
you don't know how to use the tools.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how do you build a good house? You know, like the house you build is the house you build, you know, until you get, you know, whatever life tools you need to make sure the house looks the way you want it to look.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, my wife's helped me with that a bit, you know, so, but it's, I agree with that.
Yeah.
But still having a degree would have been okay. Like, you know, I look back saying like, wow, you know, but so I had a job. I skipped Doan when he worked at the Downtown Grill. I was working at a restaurant called Papagayo's and I was working in the kitchen and
yeah, I've heard of it.
I just kind of started prepping and I ended yeah. up as sous chef. Don't know how I did that. I wasn't qualified and, just basically made specials every day. And it was just basic fruit salsas type of stuff like that.
Sure.
And then I went to work for Skip and took a job there. Because John Archer, the manager who's deceased now, was like, give him a shot. And
mm-hmm.
I got into that kitchen. It just opened up. There was a lot of structure there, like a lot of organization and structure. And he had very high demands on cleanliness and things like that. And so I got a good experience with that. So, you know, from there, I went to work for Corin. And I worked to work at Blue Light and was sous chef there. Under with Reed Anderson,
yeah,
twice actually, and then I ended up making a big roundabout loop around most of his restaurants. Coming back after a stop at the CNO back for Red Light Management, and then when Reed left, I pretty much tipped out to Maya at that point.
Yeah, that's so. I hear that too. Like living here 9 years, it's in kind of incestuous, like chefs going restaurant to restaurant to restaurant.
Well, that's good and bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good because you know if there's somebody you can count on, but it's bad because it kind of makes everything sort of pedestrian and generic sometimes.
Sure.
You know, like that's kind of the last, you know, 4 or 5 years that's kind of gone the different direction with some of the different restaurants that have come to Charlottesville.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's you know, a lot of good cooks from culinary school weren't coming to Charlottesville. Now they are. Because everybody's sort of getting out of DC, everybody's sort of getting out of New York because they don't need to work there to work in top restaurants in the country.
That was that was a question I didn't want to forget to ask you because you've been in Charlottesville kitchens for so many years. How has the scene changed? And that is one way is that outsiders, people from major metropolitan cities are coming to live here. And that's got to be it's changing the scene in a big way, I think.
I think so. I think...
I worry that the restaurants that are opening are not opening for the folks who are here year-round. Like, they're geared toward the visitors and the wedding guests and the tourists and the...
Well, the wedding business for sure is like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I believe, the second largest destination on the East Coast next to Charleston. My wife is in that business, so she's highly successful there.
Sure.
Thank God.
Yeah, and does a wonderful job.
She does. She does a great job. I mean, and she's she's one of those people that's found her what she's supposed to be doing in life, which is really great. Mm-hmm. You know, how has it changed?
I've seen it change in just since I've been here, so I can't imagine over 20 years.
Well, I feel, you know, forward-thinking food has started to just arrive here, you know, a mm-hmm. bit. And, you know, restaurants like Lampo, Moss sort of kind of broke ground on that a bit in the day.
He did.
And he sort of did it his way. I worked there for a year, so, you know, Tomas very much did it his way.
Yeah.
And what didn't really listen very closely to the customer. And, you know, and sort of stayed very true to himself, and that was great.
Yeah.
You know, but he has that personality that's able to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think now that what I worry about with Charlottesville is that there's so many restaurants, and this is probably a common thread you've heard throughout most chefs that have talked, and, you know, the size of the restaurants that are in Charlottesville are a bit is excessive, and that's where the problems are kind of aroused. The 100-seat restaurants, are a little... there's just too much competition to fill that Tuesday night seat.
Exactly.
You know, and so you're not doing a full turn in your restaurants.
Right.
So you rely on Friday and Saturday to kind of cover you as far as rent, you know, and paying for your per person average on your seats. And then that affects how you can staff your restaurant the rest of your week. So,
exactly.
So I think that's probably where the biggest change for me is that food has become... I mean, Charlottesville has a pretty high opinion of itself from a culinary standpoint. And I agree with it. I think there's a lot of talented people here, but I don't know if they're quite there. Like, you know,
I agree,
you know, and I think the media in Charlottesville does a really great job promoting us.
Yeah.
So,
well, thank you.
You know, and I think that I put myself in that too, because mm-hmm. I don't think anything that I've done warrants any type of, you know, kind of like, attention from anybody, you know. People like, you know, Ian deserves it. I think the Lampo guys really deserve it. Mm-hmm. Christian deserves it. I think the IBN deserves it, you know. Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of and you have a lot of very diverse different types of restaurants that are starting to become very successful and stay full all the time. And that's kind of what I saw. They're booked.
Yeah.
Or they're booked 2 weeks out, or they're having, you know, they're being able to be a little bit more free with their food because they're getting national notoriety.
Right.
Like IBN deserves every bit of it. Angela's like the best dude ever. Great guy.
Kidding.
You know, lovely person, great chef, great boss. Never has any mean word to say about anybody. And you know, and he's on the long list for the James Beard Award, which is great.
Yeah.
Or the short list this year. I can't remember. But like he deserves everything.
Are those out?
Well, last year, actually. The last two years he's been on that.
Yeah.
So it was what I meant to say. So well,
and I agree with you. Charlottesville, I've eaten in D.C., I've eaten all around, and we have some amazing food coming out of our city, but I do think we insulate ourselves just a little bit.
And I do feel that the people that move here, I don't know if we are able to pay, the people want to pay the price points in Charlottesville to get the quality of food that you're going to get in mm-hmm. D.C. or New York, you know,
right.
And so... You know, it's the ingredient. And I say on the other end of that, what Charlottesville does so great is that we're so surrounded by all this local produce, this local farms, cheesies, you know, whatever we want to find, there's everywhere around us. And that's awesome.
Yeah.
Which is really good. And so you know, we have grown a couple of chefs, like a lot of chefs that are uber talented, you know, super talented. And they're starting to come, I think, from the cities, I think, you know, and get there. So, but.
Yeah, because the rents in New York or in D.C. are just.
And nobody wants to work there anymore.
Hot. Yeah.
I mean, I read an article in New York Times about how difficult it is for them to find qualified help in New York City because people are getting out of school. They're going to get paid $11 mm-hmm. an hour. They have $100,000 worth of debt. They can't afford to live there.
Right.
So they're moving away. And so they're having, you know, a hard time finding like a steady stream of really good help because people can go to Stanton, Virginia, like Ian and become very highly acclaimed chef and be, you know, and, you know, do his thing, his way, the way he wants to do it, you know,
again, somebody that had his vision and, you know, had detractors and
he's said that recently though, when we were at the Glass House, I worked with him at the Glass House. I don't know if, you know, he said to me, you know, I finally, this is what I want to do right here, the Shack. And, his own boss. And you know, I love him like a brother and I admire him so much for that, you know?
No kidding. I'm curious because to me, Red Pump, just my opinion, Red Pump and Glass House are that similar type of restaurants. I mean, it's a huge number of seats, very high end fixtures and things like that. And I'm wondering what lessons you learn from working in that kind of a restaurant. I think it presents itself in a different way than a place like Bizou or Maya or or even Three Penny.
Well, it starts with ownership, I think, you know, what their perception of themselves are. You know, Glass House was I took that job from Maya as a line cook because I wanted to work with Ian. That's the only reason I went there. And it was one of the best things I've ever did. Now, Ian's a mentor to me as well. I mean, I have nothing but love and respect for him. And he's been such a great friend to me. And, you know, and I admire his food and who he is and his dedication to his vision. And he's a tough person to work with and for because he's demanding, but he's no better person mentor behind you. And that's a great blend of a chef for me. The Glass House taught me was that, what they were doing and what they wanted to do, doesn't matter how good it was, it wasn't what people wanted, you know?
There's that conflict too, because that's where the insulation comes from. We have the ability to do this very, you know, James Beard worthy star Michelin food. But the audience, there's a good portion of customer base here that just doesn't get it.
I agree. You know, and I've had Jeff Dion mentioned that, said that to me too about me, you know, because I've talked to him as a friend of friend, like, you know, why haven't I been more successful? Or, you know, he's like, you know, like, you know, he's kind of attributes my food similar to Ian's is, and I was like, well, thank you. I mean, that's the best thing anybody ever could say to me is that I don't try to emulate him, but you know, I just certainly hope I have influences from him. And
I agree.
And you know, and I, you know, Charlottesville definitely didn't really take to his style of food. Not because of, I don't know why, to be honest with you, but price probably has something to do with it, and the how expensive it is, and why is that able to work in Stanton? I don't know, but the Shack's not really that expensive.
And, that's, you know, that's what I keep trying to people.
But his rent's like nothing. I mean, it's Stanton's cheaper. He's really did a great job finding a business that could sustain what he wanted to do and live a life outside of the restaurant that he wanted to live, which is, I mean, that's in the business. That's what every chef wants to figure out.
And I remember him saying in his interview that a lot of that expense for opening a restaurant, and this came up in that, I just watched a documentary called For Grace on Netflix, and it was about how to open a 3 Michelin star restaurant. Most of the expense comes from glassware, china.
The chairs that they bought.
The chairs. And Ian mentioned, he's like, I got rid of all of that.
Well, it's helpful that he worked at Alinea. And he worked he worked at Charlie Trotter.
Right.
So he had some name drop.
For Grace guy.
So he could go to people and demand millions of dollars for investors and say, hey, I'm going to do this. And,
yeah.
You know, and he's super talented. I mean, obviously the guy's one of the best chefs in the country. So not to say that, but you know, I mean, resume has a bit to do with the ability to get investments, you know, but and deservedly so, you know, because working in those places is, you know, everybody's dream. And certainly was mine. And, you know, but then, you know, to get, you know, he sacrificed the wife and a kid and pretty much chose the restaurant over them.
Right. Again, that life path journey. Sure.
Coffee, yep.
Yeah, we might get going, guys, because we got some good coffee here. But it's that life journey, life choice. You come to these crossroads and you have to decide, okay, is this my idea of success, or is this what, you know, what I want to, you know, I want to see my husband and wife every night. You know, I want to have some free time every so often, or do I need that? You know, there's 3 little stars over my sign.
Well,
geez.
I mean, I struggle with that one to this moment in my life, you know, you know, as I was thinking about my career before you came here to understand how I actually got here, do you understand? You know, I was like, wow, you know, like, why would anybody be interested in what I have to say? You know, I mean, because I'm not saying I don't have anything worthwhile to say, but I'm just saying, like, you know, this, kind of conversations picked up on by who this person did and why they did that. And, you know, why would somebody want to listen? Not that I don't have something valuable, but like, and you know, I was like, well, I worked for Craig, I've worked for Ian, I've worked for Christian, I've worked for, you know, I've worked for a lot of people in this town that got put up on sort of a pedestal, and, you know, and I've always been sort of a behind the scenes kind of person.
The Mount Rushmore.
That, when I was trying to look at what that, I couldn't remember what that name was.
Yeah.
And, and so I've been very blessed to been able to work with a lot of like very talented people that are more talented than I am and are successful and deservedly so. And, you know, I've taken a bit from each one of those people, some more than others, but.
See, and I would, your food is amazing.
Thank you.
I would put you up on that Mount Rushmore. I totally would.
Well, thank you. I don't agree. But thank you so much. I mean, I haven't, I mean, there's a lot of people like
you're selling yourself short, I think.
Well, I think reality states in there, you know, like, you know, if you run the IVN, you've got a James, I mean, I worked for two James Beard nominated chefs. That's great, you know, but I haven't done anything like that. And I think that, you know, my food's, I've had good and I've had bad. And, you know, you mentioned the Red Pump experience for me was, you know, I would say not a great one, but like, you know, that had not as much to do with me as anything else. And, what I learned from there was that, you know, you need to pay attention to the details before you take on a task and you're not aware of everything, you know, not that anybody, like I was, you know, I didn't think it through all the way to make sure that I did all my homework and research to make sure I was a good fit for what I was looking, people were looking for.
See, that's another part of it. That definition of success. I have said yes to things that I thought would bring me more press, you know, more accolades, and I don't regret them. But thinking, I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to do that again. That really did nothing for me, and I got nothing out of it. And I judged the James Beard Book Awards last year,
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a fun experience in that I got to read some of the most amazing food writing that I've ever been presented with. And food writing is such a small genre, so I probably wouldn't have been exposed to it because you really do have to seek it out. It's not a, they're not popular. It's not a popular genre on Amazon. Everybody wants cookbooks.
True.
They don't want the deeper
with pictures.
With lots of pictures, lots of instruction. They don't want the deeper, more thoughtful pieces. So that part of it was incredible, but it showed me, and I'll probably never be asked again, but that doesn't matter to me.
I doubt that. Don't, once again, you're saying yourself, just like you said to me, not to sell yourself so short.
But it showed me, I guess it took the rose colored glasses off my eyes, and it showed me the business and the back slapping and the, you know, you wash my hand, I'll wash your hand kind of part of the food business that really just turned me off.
Well, the bottom line is money.
You know, when it comes to the metals and the money.
Red Pump, they spent a ton of money to get that space there as an example. So the bottom line is very important, and that's really hard to say, when it's drilled down to the 10th of a percentage number, you know, and they want a return on their investment.
Yeah.
And that's understandable, you know, I think that's the hard part for people to kind of grasp and to get. If you don't come out of school, one thing school will teach you is a little bit about is food costing and labor costing and all the numbers behind it. Because good food just isn't good enough.
Yeah.
Because I've seen a lot of good food. Yeah, I've seen a lot of good restaurants go under.
Yeah.
And have great food. You know, I've seen a lot of businesses go under that have made their numbers with bad food. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot of restaurants that have had bad food become very successful. And, you know, because whatever the niche they sell to, people come, and it really matters at the end of the day, from a numbers and cents perspective, you know, dollars and cents is like, you know, is that person's in the seat? You know, are you getting value for that chair?
Sure.
You know, and is that, you know, affecting how many turns you do, like, you know, and goes into that and, you know, and, you know, institutional cooking does that. And there's a lot of like, not every person is going to have, you know, a James Beard chef job. You know, people are going to work at Aramark, or they're going to work at this place, and you know, you have two kids and you got to put them through college and you got to take a job making this when you could be making that. You know, people make choices in life, and that's,
there are many paths
to get to, and you got to come to like kind of grips with that. And so, I mean, that's kind of where I'm at right now, is like where I'm
trying to find your fit.
Yeah. And I don't, I took the job at the school because I wanted to positively affect people coming forward in their careers about how I thought they should learn something. You know, mainly from being taught from things that I felt like I didn't do well early in my career. You know, and being drilled into things like work ethic, cleanliness, things that I had to like get drill into myself to, sure. to become a quote unquote professional. Yeah. You know, and you know, the earlier people get that, the better, so that they can you know, seamlessly kind of fit into whatever system people work in the restaurant. See, so,
and I bet you're an amazing teacher, because I if I was going to be a culinary student, I would prefer to learn from someone who has been out there in the trenches for two decades rather than some highfalutin guy in a toque that's been teaching at CIA for 30 years and hasn't stepped in a restaurant kitchen in forever.
And I think that the regional culinary school is kind of where it's going to end up being, because yeah. New England culinary is gone. It's, you know, people are trying to decide what to do with that. And, you know, large, smaller culinary schools like the one I work at are talking about buying it, you know? And so the course is, you know, 22 grand or something like that. It's not $75,000, you know, it's shorter.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's problems with the curriculum, but I think, you know, most people don't want to come out of school to get a $10 an hour job, you know, and no benefits at 28 years old and two kids and have to pay rent and, you know, have $100,000 worth of debt. You know, I mean, that's, you know, CIA is upwards of $130,000 now to get a degree. And, you know, kids coming right out of high school in the CIA, that's a great thing because their parents can pay. But, you know, they've never worked in a restaurant. They have no idea if they're going to be any kind of good at it. And, you know, and then they get into, they want to be chefs when they get out and think they're going to make a lot of money. And they're just,
thanks, Top Show.
Yeah, pretty much. Food the Food Network. Yeah, I mean, I was going to get that. I hate people always get mad when I say that. But like, yeah, it's the Food Network's fault. So, but it also kind of bred a different style of culinary student where they're serious. They're not addicts. You know, they're, you know.
The culture of the kitchen
has changed. Yeah. Because now they're
it's not the Tony Bourdain culture where, you know, they're.
Yeah, it's not about just
snorting
being fast.
Coke lines off the
totally,
off the
you know, and they've elevated our profession from being just sort of like a you know, a craft into making art out of it, and you know, and also to be they're serious about being detail oriented and specific, and it's because as Ian always told me, he's like, what we do is important to chefs. You know, we feed people. You know, that's important, and you know, feed people the right way, feed people with, you know, sustainable food, feed people the proper amount of food. You know, and serve it to them in the way that makes them feel wholesome when they leave is important. You know, I mean, and it's a responsibility.
Absolutely.
And you have to take, you know, and so it's not just like we're not just like blue collar grunts grinding it out in 1984.
Yeah.
You know, for no money and, you know, not being able to clock in until 7 hours into your shift. It's just not really like that anymore in the kitchen. So it's like, so I think that's a really big benefit that, that culinary school has done for us is that. Recently.
Yeah, recently.
It's legitimized. I mean, it's, you know, it's a kind of a sexy, kind of looked at as a job that's kind of interesting until they have to scrub a bunch of fryers and clean the grease trap out with their hand. But like,
or their refrigerator breaks down and they don't know who to call. And
yeah, so
I hear a lot of that too on Facebook.
Yeah.
Hey, I mean, you got a guy? I need a guy.
Can I borrow your RoboCube blade? Or, can I, you know, I need to borrow a box of time because I forgot to order it. I mean, the restaurant business is about, it's a small community and, you know, and really people, you know, generally get along well and try to like, you know, be neighborly to the other restaurants. It's, you know, I tried to not really pay attention to what other restaurants were doing. I didn't really care.
Sure.
You know, so.
Well, God, I feel like you work so hard and the hours are so long, you don't have time even. You're just worried about what's in front of you.
And I mean, you do all that and, you know, and it doesn't go well. And that's, you know, it's failure sometimes. It's not failure if you kind of learn, you know.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, like I left Red Pump feeling that, you know, that I didn't do. It wasn't what I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
And I don't think this ownership was what they wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and that's nobody's fault. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you ask me, you know, what did that teach me? You know, I worked my whole career to get to that point and then it didn't work out. And that was hard for me. You know, that was difficult for me to, because I hadn't really had any type of like, I wouldn't say failure, but I hadn't, you know, I've been successful most places I've been pretty well and given a lot of free rein to do what I wanted to do. And, you know, when I got into an environment where they, you know, that wasn't that way. It was difficult. So I had to learn that, you know, it's not, you know, it's not about your ego. It's not about, you know,
yeah.
You know, sometimes, you know, you have to capitulate. You can do what you want to do.
And
so,
exactly.
So I took the teaching job because of that. And also hours were great. You know, I mean, honestly, like I went from working 75, 80, 90 hours a week to working 40. And that was kind of awesome. You know, like, so. Yeah.
Oh my God. Like I can sit and have a cup of coffee and a conversation in the morning if I feel like it.
Spend time with my wife and go on a date and do things like that, which was great. So,
and I see that as incredibly courageous too, like to step back and you go, you know, no, this is not for me. You know, my ship is not point. It's against the wind. I need to kind of step back and reevaluate and see. Do you feel like teaching is good for now, or is this where you want to? Is this what you want to do for a while, or are you just kind of?
I like it. I mean, I found the. I mean, it's a corporation just like any.
Sure.
You know, what I've taught myself is that I like to work in environments like Maya, where it's an owner-operator-driven restaurant.
Yeah.
They're there. I can have a dialogue with them about what's going on. Working for a corporation, which is in essence what I did at Red Pump. I worked for a restaurant group. I wasn't, you know, I didn't feel like that was for me.
Mm-hmm.
So the school is like that. You know, there's a lot of things that don't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there's a lot of value to being able to like shape somebody's life.
Sure.
You know,
okay.
I look at it like sponsoring somebody in AA. You know, really like kind of get in and, you know, and the way I say is like, I'm not an expert on food, but I am an expert on my food. And like, you know, and so I can show you, you know, I can show you how to make beurre blanc, no problem. You know, everybody knows how to do that in America, like that can cook, you have to, you know, but why does it work? How is it working? What's the science behind it? You know, I find for me, like the research about technique is as enjoyable to me as the putting it on the plate.
Hmm.
So, you know, for example, like that one plate you put up for lineup and you're showing a special to to the servers, that plate's for me. You know what I'm saying? That's the one for me that I see my vision and how
in
I want
head.
It to go out. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's great, I feel rewarded by that.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of them aren't for me. They're the customers paying for them. And, you know, and so I try to teach stuff like that to them, you know, like, you know, I add something on every day to the lesson that's not in the curriculum, you know, but I also run the class like I run my kitchen, which is different from a lot of other instructors there. Like they're not allowed to come in if they're 5 minutes late, they go home for the day.
Oh, I like that.
You know,
good for you.
You know, they're not allowed to.
That's good.
If they don't turn their homework in, they're not allowed to come into class. You know, and so, you know, like so, I get. And then that, I've had a lot of pushback on that one, but like, but you know, for the you know, and I was viewed as being a bit strict, but you know, when they got in my class, and I, you know, I'm scrubbing dishes with them all night long. I'm, you know, cooking food, and so I try to give them a sense, even though it's not necessarily there's no pressure or sense of urgency. That you can't replicate except during dinner service, which is where most people fail at in the restaurant business because they can't ramp themselves up to be fast. You know, they can't maintain quality with increase of speed. And so most people aren't able, you know, that's where I feel that most line cooks suffer because they get dirty or their knife cuts, or, you know, the quality starts to slip and they're not able to hold themselves to standards the busier they get. So, you know, that's hard to replicate in school. When you're not producing food for sale. So, you know, I try to do that a little bit. Like they'll have three dishes. They all have to come up at the same time.
Sure.
You know, and I try to replicate it a bit, but it's good. I like it. I don't think it's like my long-term vision though. Like I don't see it. And you know, what is that? To be honest, I'm not 100% certain, you know,
it's good for now.
I know what I don't want to do. Maybe that's the better way to look at it. You know, I know what I don't want you know, and I know what I love to do, which, you know, the last 3 years I've really taken on like projects to teach myself things like baking, you know, bread or fermentation, more projects like that, working on, you know, kombucha or, you know, pickles like, you know, kimchi and
sure.
So I always have like in my closet here, I've got five different kombuchas going right now and, you know, and I've got my starters, I got, you know, so I'm like,
right.
So I bake a lot and I'm teaching myself baking and things like that. So I love that, you know, so. You know, maybe I'd like to be a baker. You know, pizza's my thing. I got to be honest. Mm-hmm. Like, so, you know, if, you know, Lauren's, who's supremely talented.
That's where you got your start? At the brick oven?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And well, and from that, you know, like, you know, naturally leavened bread from, you know, like doing it my way, I guess, and not the way. Does that make so? Mm-hmm. I'm interested in that, and I don't think there's a right way. So
your pizza at Red Pump was great.
Thanks,
it was really good.
And I've, since then, I've sort of refined a bit. And
I'm a snob.
Oh,
people here go on and on about the pizza, and I just roll my eyes and go, "Okay, that's your opinion."
For about 2 weeks is what I wanted, and then you know, I became a negotiation with ownership.
But there's that too.
But Lauren, for example, who I have a lot of respect for,
you know,
Lampo's once again a tiny restaurant. It's mm-hmm. full all the time. It looks busy. The food's great.
Yeah,
it's very creative.
Yeah,
his pizza's awesome. You know, that would be a mold of something that I could get behind. But you know, there's not enough room in Charlottesville for I think multiple ones.
Right.
You know, and nor would I want to compete with him. He's done a great job. But like I look at his business and I say, you know, that's really something I admire.
That model and
mm-hmm. and his food. I mean, mm-hmm. quite frankly, you know, it's good.
Yeah, it is very good.
And he's put quality over quantity. He stays busy. They get great ingredients, you know. It's technically driven. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all technically great chefs.
Mm-hmm.
They're creative. So there's a lot to admire about that business model. So for me, I think maybe a pizza restaurant. I've thought Richmond. So, I don't know.
They could use one because bottoms up, it ain't all that.
Right.
Oh, my God.
And there's a lot of people there. You know, there's a lot more.
There's room for that more experimentation or to have more than one of something.
Exactly. And, you know, people live in different parts of Richmond.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like you could have a thing. Mike lives there. I don't know if you know Mike Yeager, but like he worked with us at the Glass House. He works at the school too. You know, we've talked a bit about that.
I've seen the name about,
good
bandied
dude.
About. Yes.
Somebody you should talk to.
That's why somebody recommended him to me.
He worked for Craig, then he worked for Melissa, then he worked for Ian.
That's why yes.
And so, and then he worked for Joe and the Roosevelt guy's name's I'm drawing a blank on
Roosevelt. Right? Oh, Lee Gregory.
Lee Gregory. So he worked at South Bend. So he's worked for some.
Yeah. Did you hear Owen Lane left for Nashville? I'm kind of upset about that. He used to run the Magpie. Then he was at Vagabond.
So that's no longer there?
I think Vagabond's still there, but he. I saw a post the other day. He's like, the truck's packed. See you in Nashville.
I'm like, no. I like the food at Vagabond.
Me too.
And I like the food at Magpie.
Yeah.
Both places. He's a good dude too, by the way.
Yes, he is.
Owen's a really nice guy.
But again, like Magpie, probably the best brunch I've ever eaten mm-hmm. in my life. But he was very heavily game-centered in his menu, mm-hmm. like a lot of rabbit, a lot of venison. And I don't think people took to it, or not to keep the restaurant open, obviously. Like, they weren't, that just wasn't a thing.
I think it goes back to the point we were talking about earlier, where, you know, there's about 100 chefs in the world that can cook whatever they want, and people will be booked 6 months out, you know. But I don't think that sometimes you have to sell food that people buy, unfortunately, and find creativity and individuality in there somewhere, and stay true to your concept. And, you know, and that's, you know, and I think that's why Ian's concept of inspired American has always appealed to me, because mm-hmm. it's pretty much whatever you want to make.
It's very broad.
Very broad. And him and I have talked about that. He's like, I make whatever I want, Todd, and I put it on the plate. And
people,
you know, and that's what I do.
What do I have in my kitchen today?
Exactly.
And how do I, you know, how can I make it taste the best possibly can?
And we really I love working there, because every mm-hmm. day we talk about, what are we making today? What are we doing?
Yeah.
And Mike and I would sit down and put our heads together, mainly them two. But like, we would talk about, like, what's the menu going to look like today? Because he would change the menu every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, that goes to another thing about consistency. Like, you know, I think I took the trout off at Maya because I got so bored with it. And then everybody got super pissed, you know, and there's
a favorite.
Christian's like, we got to put it back on. And so I think that concept of having a static menu and running a bunch of specials is like, you know, very, very comforting to restaurant owners.
That's so funny. I really identify with your personality, because my dad always tells people, well, she doesn't know what she wants to do, but she knows 60 jobs she doesn't want to do. Like you, and I hear that in you, like you've spent your life trying. Like,
I had a path that I thought I knew what it was, and I got there, and it wasn't like this great thing opened up for me.
Yeah.
The opposite, in fact. And, you know, that's not, I don't want to like I'm not trying to disparage any person or myself for that matter, but it just, things sometimes just don't work out. It's like being in a bad relationship. You know, it's not anybody's fault. You just break up.
I used to beat myself up about it a lot. Like, what do you want to do? What do you want to be? And I'm like, I don't know. And now I'm like, I'm so glad I did that. I think more people should be willing to, hey, let me go down here and see what's down this road.
And that's, having a great wife is part of the benefit. A supportive spouse in my life is an important part there. I mean, there is no better person that I've ever met in my life than my wife. And
She's amazing.
She is. And she's kind of like, go do your thing over here. And, let's just, do you. And, I work at Oakhart now. I've worked there 2 days now. And,
I like those guys. I like what they're doing.
I do too. I love it. He's got a good crew.
Yeah.
Food's good, approachable, well prepared. Mm-hmm. They've developed a really good vibe in the dining room, which is, kind of like almost what I see is like, if people are energetic and happy when they're eating and it's for that style of service that they do, it kind of meshes really well. Mm-hmm. And the people that work there are great. Their kitchen crew is great.
Mm-hmm.
I've known Ben for a long time. I had been interview with Lynn and Dean for the general management position at Red Pump when I got there, and they didn't hire him. So I've always been close.
Yeah.
And I like Tristan, his best friend, and I like him. So, we've kind of talked loosely about the future, and, I think they kind of want me to have a role like I had at Maya there. I'm kind of happy with working taking a couple days to teach and a couple days to cook right now. And
that sounds great. It sounds perfect.
I like it.
I'm curious about, you mentioned in teaching, researching a dish and how you walk your students through it. And I'm curious about your process, like when you decide to create a dish and how you do your research for that.
Like, well, it starts with it starts with flavor driven for me. Like I don't think of a technique. Like I don't think, well, I'm going to have crispy Brussels sprouts. And like, I think of the flavor.
Yeah.
And, I can't take credit for it. I got it from Grant Ackett's from Flavor Bouncing.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I think about, well, here's my main focus is pork belly. And from that, beer goes well with that. And beer goes well with peanut. And beer also goes well with malt. And beer, I develop a flavor and I think of that. And then I start to think about the texture and technique that I want to apply to that flavor.
Oh, nice.
How am I going to get sweet, sour, salty, bitter? And how I'm going to get, umami and texture into my mouth in that bite. And then, I definitely am more small plate driven than large plate driven. I get kind of bored with, 1-2-3 plate, as I call it, where you got the starch, veg, and throw protein on and get it out. I would rather have, serving a tasting menu for me is better. What I like to do, but also serving small plates like Moss would do, or what also works for me, where I can, be a little bit more liberal with food cost and also with with technique on the plate, with, I'm not trying to serve a complete plate in the sense of a customer thinks about it.
See, for me, the appetizers always seem more exciting than the mains in restaurants. And I know a lot of that is you have to appeal to your customer base and, make sure you get that ticket average per plate thing.
Well, actually,
$42 or whatever it is.
It's an illusion. The customer thinks they spend less money they'll spend more money eating in a style of restaurant like Moss.
Yeah.
But they don't think so because the price points on the menu are low.
Yeah.
And so, you kind of trick, and then you end up, I always end up spending $150 when I go into Moss. So, worth it. I'm not saying it's not worth it. I'm just saying that it's just like, oh, that looks good. And that looks good. And that, it just sort of all starts coming at you and, and you start eating it and you're like saying, like, if you happen to go that or some sangria,
right.
I want some bread or whatever, so that's kind of the style of Oakhart too. They have small plate driven food.
And Parallel too, sadly, they're closing this week. I always enjoyed their food.
Well, that's location driven, I think.
Yeah. Charlottesville thing.
Well, I think it's, they don't want to eat over north side of town for some reason. Doesn't matter how good anything is. I've actually never eaten at Parallel 38, so I don't know, but I heard things about it that were great. And what's his name?
Justin Ross.
And
the wine program over there is so good too. Such unusual wines, like things I had never tried before, and service was always good, and
people like, you know, and yeah, I mean, that's, there's so much wanna, like restaurant debt, like, you know, when you do your location. Research, where to put your location is the first thing that pops up.
Yeah, that's true.
And then next thing is rent versus how many seats you can have, and are you going to turn that?
Right. And it's a huge space.
It is.
Again, that the big 100 seat space issue thing pops up again.
But, you know, so then I guess after that, I think about, you know, what did I get in today? You know, what's fresh, you know, what's seasonal, what's like, you know, how can I highlight this and do it justice? The last few years I've, you know, I always, until recently in my career, I've tried to be smart with food, like try to quote unquote challenge my customers, you know, like as I looked at it that way, and I felt, you know, more as I look back on it now that, you know, like modernist cooking techniques, whatever you want to look, are tools. And you put the right tool to the right job to get it out right. Sometimes the old way is the best way to do it, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Not trying to outsmart your clientele, you know, and trying to be smarter than them, or seem like you're trying to be smarter than them, is maybe not the way to go.
Yeah.
You know, it should seem effortless, I guess, if that makes any sense. But and then I'm making sure that I'm trying not to be too complicated. You know, I really have to dial back ingredient. Ian taught me that lesson as he moved forward. It's like, you know, not why do 7 ingredients when you can do 5? Just for the sake of being.
It's like, my mother used to quote Chanel or Coco Chanel. She'd say, always remove one accessory before you leave the house.
Yeah, that's something.
Don't overload it.
Exactly. And he said something that I just started to kind of grasp in my food, is that, you know, the more confident you are in your cooking, the less things you put on the plate. And that's, you know, something. And I never got that, because I was like, I'm going to put foam and glass and blah, blah, you know, and do all that stuff. Yeah. And which I like those things. I'm not saying I wouldn't use them, but I'm just saying, like, you know, maybe having 4 or 5 kind of, not ingredients, but main focuses on the plate at one time. So then I say, okay, now I want to make bacon. All right, well, let's talk about bacon. You know, we're going to make our own bacon today. You know, what is the technique we're processing here? And they're like, well, it's curing. And I was like, that's true. You know, but, you know, it's smoking as well. It's curing. What's happening with nitrates? You know, what's happening with your salt? What's the salt doing on your plate? You know, what's the purpose of the curing? Is it flavor? Is it, you know, is it preservation driven? You know, think what the result is here and work your way backwards to the raw ingredient so that you understand the process.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then figure out what the technique is you're working with. And then you start worrying about, all right, well, how am I going to accentuate this? You know, am I going to use rose water in my marinade? What am I doing? You know, like, how am I going to, you know, do I just want garlic and rosemary in my bacon? What about maple syrup? What about bourbon? What about all the, you know, all these things you can build upon to that, you know, that don't take the place of the technique. And so,
but each thing serves a purpose. It's not just there to impress or be extraneous.
Put salt on it and not understand why you're doing that.
Right.
It's, you know, what is the function of salt in cooking, for example, for that matter, but like, what is it that you're trying to achieve here? You know, and, you know, culinary school is not about teaching food art to anybody. It's about teaching process and like, and details.
Right.
And how to understand fermentation, how to understand, you know, why you're butchering the tenderloin the way you're butchering it. You know, why roux makes the sauce thick. You know, what is a hydrocolloid? Absolutely. You got to understand that so you can apply properly the technique to the food that you're trying to prepare. And is there a better way to do it than they did it 50 years ago?
Yeah.
You know, like 100 years ago. So, you know, do you
ever send your students, I'm having like a brain fart here. I got really upset. I don't watch Top Chef anymore, but I did hear that they highlighted Edna Lewis on one episode, and I got incensed because half the contestants didn't know who she was. Do you teach your students about like the chefs that came before, like the people that have the pioneers, the folks that, you know, developed this and this and, you know, the great ones?
We talk about
history a little bit.
In theory, the curriculum is based on New England culinary's theory.
Okay.
The curriculum. It's a condensed version of that. The director of my school helped to formulate the curriculum for all of the culinary's.
Oh, wow.
10 years ago. And he went to New England culinary. So there's a heavy emphasis on classic French cooking, as it should be.
I mean,
you have
learn the basics, the classics, before you
And nobody really cooks that way. I mean, there are people that use roux and butter and, you know, and everything, but not many people do anymore. So it's important, I think, to understand what's happening when you can put flour and butter together and, you know, where the starch, why it thickens it. And is there another product to do that besides that? That's better. Sometimes that's great. You want to make a bechamel, you got to do that. You know, if you want to make an actual bechamel. If you want to replicate a bechamel using something else, you can do that too.
Right.
But it ceases to become a bechamel because it's no longer made that way. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So I think the distinction is lost, in my opinion, there. I'm very much classically driven, but I don't think that's the right way to do it. I just think that to call it velouté, it needs to be made that way. That doesn't mean you can't make the same product doing a different way. But I feel we talk about Escoffier, we talk about, you know, Carme, we talk about all that. We talk about Paul Bocuse, you know, the curriculum that we teach is very fast, you know, whereas they're doing it in a year, we're doing it in 12 weeks.
Oh yeah.
So like, you know, our classes are, you know, it's a 5-hour class. I lecture for about an hour and a half, which is the hardest thing that I've had to learn how to do. And then we go into the lab.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, if they're not done with their food, I throw it away at the end of the day. I'm like, you're got to be done by in the service. So, you know, and then you get
a
zero.
That's good.
So, but they, you know, they get it. And most people are interested in it and they do. And they work in pairs of two. And I set the class up. So I don't want them to fail. I want them to be successful, you know. So, but, you know, they get a taste of it. But so we talk about classics as it pertains to what we're doing. And I talk about like today's pork day. You know, we're talking about the parts of the pig, what all the things you can do with it, like, you know, what sustainable pork really is, you know, the difference between you're going to go to the grocery store to get your pork or you're going to go to Timber Creek and get your pork, you know, something like that, you know, wherever your local farm of choice, you can go there and get that. And we talk about, you know, how they did it classically, you know, and then we're going to talk about how we're going to do it today. You know, and we always have three recipes that we have to work through that day. And one of them will be something I base in classic cooking. One's going to be a little bit more of a, you know, experiment. So they think about things in big picture. And then why are they the same? Why is the result the same? You know, so why do you end up, and, you know, I'll bring my sous vide machine in and I'll show them that and say, this is the same result. Is it better or worse? Can you tell the difference? You know, that kind of thing.
That's so cool. That's God. I would take that class. Just do people take it just to home cooks? Like they're not really. They're just kind of trying to up their skills, and they've got the money for the 12-week course.
No, I've done it. Well, I've done a couple cooking classes at the Happy Cook with our true home cooks, and you know, I did a knife skills class.
Yeah.
And most of those people don't want to do that.
Right.
You know, like it. You know, like I had them cut everything in the class, and and it was valuable. I got like good reviews back from it, but I think they more wanted me to watch me do it.
So that they can,
and there's some, a few did want to do it, but I feel like that wasn't the right, I didn't approach that the right way. So I you know, I said, here's a carrot. This is how you cut it. Now you guys cut it. You know, here's a cucumber. This is how you cut it. One of the ways to cut it. Now you guys cut it. And like, so I ran that. So I think the home cook would do that. And they really want to be demonstrated because really, you know, they're not going to come home at night and spend a lot of time making their knife cuts perfect. They're just going to make sure you don't have to do that to make food taste delicious.
Right.
You know, and then you have people that want to go to school that maybe want to learn that. And I'd say probably 50% of the people are willing to do those things that pay to go to school.
Right. God, this is why I want to win the lottery. I would just take, I would like the pork class, like, you know, tasting the different types of preparations. And like, I find that fascinating because I know I have a better palate than when I started 10 years ago. And I feel like it could be even better.
Me too, for that matter. You know, I mean, Tomas Rahal probably has the best palate of anybody I've ever been around, and you know, and
he's good.
He is good, and he, you know, and he's his you know, I mean, his palate in general, not necessarily every, you know, that works for him, but he's, you know, he probably has. I could have learned a lot more there than I did when I worked there, you know, because I wasn't really interested in learning that much when I worked there. but you know, but I could have a better palate too, you know, and I really think about that when I'm tasting food, so. You know, everybody has a flavor profile they kind of gravitate towards, and mine's acid. So my food tends to have a bit of acidity to it that I need to pay attention to it, though, because it gets, you know.
It can get too much.
It can. And, you know, especially in desserts, because I try to have most of my desserts end up having a savory note to them. And, you know, and I have to kind of pay attention to that a bit. So, but, you know, you know, you always have a...
Like, what's a good savory dessert that you do? I'm curious. Because I actually prefer cheese as a dessert.
I do too. I love that. And we get that too. I mean, I don't like things very sweet, although when I cook, but when I eat, I like things very sweet. Does that make sense? So, like, I, you know, one of my favorites is I just take pound cake and I take Nutella and I spread it on there for myself. Yeah. But, you know, but I like, you know, I did a caprese dessert one time when I made a mozzarella foam with tomato ice cream. And I did canned tomato jam, and then I made like a really a cracker out of rye, you know, that I made that I baked it as a cracker, and I brushed it with like a glucose solution that's mixed with lemon juice, and then I spritzed it with balsamic from an atomizer at the end, and it's very savory.
Dude, I bet that was so good.
But I sold like one of them a week, you know. Yeah. Like nobody really wanted it. So
the customer base, they like to think that they're adventurous, but. Not yet. Maybe Richmond a little bit.
It's kind of a bit arrogant on my part to try to, you know, that's not really a Maya. That was when I was at Maya. That wasn't really a Maya dessert, you know, and they wanted, like, I'm trying to cook to my ego and not to what the customers want. Right.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. And that's part of running a successful restaurant. Sure. Is you have to have that balance. You know, your vision, but you've also got to meet the bottom line and get people in seats.
And realize that, in hindsight, that it was Christian's vision, not my vision. And I have to do what he, you know, and he gave me a lot of room to have my vision, but, you know, be like, you know, now I'd have been like, come on, man, what are you trying to serve that dessert there for? Right. You know, like, but that's hindsight's 20/20.
Yeah, no kidding. What do you enjoy doing when you're not teaching and working at Oakhart and fermenting and... What are your hobbies and passions?
I play golf.
Ah, that's right. You did mention
not
that.
So much recently, but, you know, I read a lot. You know, I hate to say it, but I bake a lot of bread.
Oh.
You know, that's fun. I enjoy that.
I do that as well. Successfully sometimes.
You know, I'm kicking around an idea to take a class at Piedmont, so which I'm probably going to sign up for tomorrow.
Cool.
But, sorry.
Oh, puppy's okay.
Sorry. She hates trucks. I'm sorry. That's the ambient noise you were talking about there.
Exactly. That's completely fine.
You know, I worked nights for so long that it's like, you know, you go to work at 8, 10 in the morning, you get off at 10 and 12 at night. You know, you don't really have things that you like to do, you know, I used to like going drinking.
Yeah. Right.
So I got out of that. And so then, you know, I really liked my job and I like cooking and I enjoy that. I cook, you know, here a lot, you know, we cook at home most every night. You know, so I enjoy cooking for, you know, we have a live-in teenage daughter sort of person now. That's not really my daughter, but you know, so it's a good family life here now, which we like that. You know, so you know, a lot of my time is doing things like that, like going to yoga and going to the gym.
Oh, you take yoga.
Oh, she does. And I have taken yoga a bit, and I have to say, I enjoy it. It's hard.
That mind-body connection, which works a lot of crap out.
It does.
It really does.
It's a total body workout, too. And I think a lot of men are like, yoga.
Right. They don't get
man, I was never more sore than the first day after my first yoga class I did, which she had me like sit on my hands and like put my knees behind my hands and like sit and hold myself up by my leg. I mean, I was like my arms. I was like very hard and then, you know, and made it look very easy and I fell over and like, you know, it's very hard. So I enjoy it. You know, it's good. It is a good for the chi and the spirit and you know, that connection there and finding perspective. So I like that. And golf for me is that way too.
You know? That's what my husband calls it, a nice walk in the park.
It is. It's great. It's one of the few things I can do where I don't like turn other things over.
Yeah. You're kind of in the zone, just in the moment, not thinking about anything else.
And, you know, and happily so, you know, which is for me, usually I'm like, you know, I'm a bit of a obsessive person by nature and I can't turn it off sometimes if that, you know, like, and, you know, when I'm in... My wife says it, you know, now that I'm have a lot better ability to be present than when I would be at work or things were there. And I hate to say it, but kind of tune out what was going on around me and be thinking about the walk-in tomorrow or, you know, like I had to do this because they weren't happy with that or, you know, or like I had to, you know, somebody called out sick and I had to, you know, so I, you know, I'd sit there and, you know, the people like
that I know, like Tucker, for example, just kind of like, you know, he can turn it off. So
how do you do that? Like, well, he's got,
I've always got nine kids, you know, like he's got like five, six kids and he's busy.
That's true. Do you ever think you'll write? Because I know you mentioned writing is an interest. Do you ever think you'll pick that up?
I do. I have a tendency to think that my writing would be like a string of consciousness than more of like a, like sort of like how I hear myself talking right now. Like,
yeah.
So we're kind of like,
yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. Maybe, you know, I feel, I don't know if I the intimidating writing 25 pages, you know, as an essay or an article or something kind of intimidates me a bit, you know, mm-hmm. so I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if my grammar is good enough really to do that,
that
you know.
That doesn't matter.
That don't matter.
As I say, that don't matter.
Maybe steps. Maybe I could, we could have a chat about that sometime.
Yeah. Hearing you talk about how you create a dish, maybe I'm self-centered and my ego is telling me this. I feel that if I'm very interested in reading and hearing about that process. So there's got to be more than one person.
Oh, I'm sure there's lots for different people.
Yeah.
I think a common mistake people make is that they make it, like sometimes you'll see something that looks so good that you're like, it sort of tells you how you want to make it and you want to highlight that. But I do feel that people are wrap their heads around like beef. I have to make a beef dish, right? And so then they're stuck in that, right? Instead of saying, well, I really want to highlight rhubarb. Beef can be a component, even though it's the most expensive component on it, but I want to, you know, and they kind of limit themselves to being able to feel like, you know, that the protein or the fish or, you know, is the highlight of the dish. And it doesn't have to be that way all the time, you know, in fact, shouldn't be that way all the time. Quite frankly, I think, you know, I think that's not economically sustainable in the American culture. And I also don't feel like it's like, you know, sustainable from a health perspective.
Absolutely.
You know, like you're forcing 12 ounces of red meat protein on somebody's throat six nights a week. And, you know, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know,
one of my passionate causes is Appalachian cuisine. And that is the basis of their cuisine is food as a condiment. It was never the center. It was always the flavor, a flavoring agent or a side to the rest of the stuff on the plate. And I would love to see more. And I think that is happening where more restaurants are embracing that idea.
I agree. And maybe that is the one focus into, like, you know, when you have smaller cities that are used to saying, well, oh, what's the, you know, you have a menu, you only have three proteins on here. And why am I spending $13 for a carrot dish? Right.
Yeah.
You know, and they're having a hard time wrapping their brain around that, you know? And so, I've got local carrots and this guy's farm produced them and they're expensive.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, and this is a business and I have to make money.
Yeah.
And like, you know, like this is what it cost me to produce carrots for
yeah.
you. So that's why it's $13. And people are like, well, I can go over here and get the same carrots for.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
And a big steak.
Right. For. So I think it's difficult. And you know, and I think that's, you know, I think the creativity is like, instead of worrying about that, worrying about, well, I have to have a chicken. I have to have a pork, a chicken, a lamb dish, you know, and I have to fill this menu out in some kind of preconceived kind of way of viewing how a menu should be structured, you know, and instead of, you know, looking at it from a sense of what people are bringing you to you.
I read this great piece recently. I'll have to look up and see who wrote it, but she mentioned that about, you know, for most of the population, eating out is a special event thing. They save up for it. It's once a year, maybe three times a year. So they want to feel like, you know, it's pampered. It's a celebration. They want that big porterhouse. You know, they want the big creme brulee at the end or the big fudge cake or whatever. And then you've got this other population that is so knowledgeable about food that they're willing to pay the $13 for the carrots. And it's like, how do we...
And I think that's...
How do we... There's room for both.
I think so. And I think probably so much competition for a seat is difficult for that, you know? And I think that back, you know, 30 years ago, there weren't a lot of restaurants. They were busier because when everybody had less choices to go out and get these. Right.
Yeah.
And now, and you can sell beef all the time if you're full all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because nobody makes money off beef. So like, you know, you have to have balance on your menu when it comes to costing, and you have to be able to have things on the menu. You can't just serve truffles, caviar, foie, and beef, you know, because you go out of business, you know, because nobody makes money off that kind of stuff. You know, you put shrimp on the menu so you can serve that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
You know, and so you have to have the balance. And so everybody expects a beef dish on the menu. So you have it. But, you know, it's what I call revenue drivers and not profit drivers. So you want to have, and, you know, trying to get this concept to students is difficult. You know, they're like, well, you know, if it's $16 a pound for beef and, you know, the plate needs to be $41 for you to make money, you know, properly because of how your the rest of your menu set up. And then, you know, like, but you can't serve it for that. You have to serve it for $29. You know, so you take a loss on it, but you know, if you sell 30 of those steaks, it's a revenue driver because you have to have a constant stream of money coming in because it takes a lot of shrimp to make money, you know, even though you're making a lot of profit on it. Does that make sense? So, so you fill your restaurant up with your menu up with things like profit drivers that make profit for you. And you also have revenue drivers that make you a lot of actual revenue. It's like your checking account, you know, your bills come in and you pay your bills and you know, at the end,
and you say this other little,
it's a constant negotiation,
it's a good analogy.
You know, between constant negotiation between your menu, dynamic. One thing I learned great from Dean and Lynn was that, you know, that you can't be emotionally attached to an item on your menu. If it's great, but nobody buys it, it's taking up space on your menu and it's gotta go. You know, and so it calls them dogs and stars. And so, you know, looking at that and being like, God, I really love that dish. And but nobody's buying it. So, you know, like, why you have it? I mean, why is it there? You know, so.
It's the reality.
It's the reality of it. So I think there's that kind of negotiation in the restaurant now is becoming the people that are growing, that are the, you know, the millennials that are coming into being out diners that are eating out, that are willing to eat like the way that we're talking about right now. And then you have an older crowd that it's used to eating a certain way. Right. And so, there's a line of demarcation there that divides that. And so you can't just appeal to one or the other now, but eventually I do feel that it's going to be,
it's going to switch over a little
simply
bit.
Because of the age of our patrons. And
Exactly. And this has been such a great conversation. And I do have some really fun kind of speed round questions, but I can't leave the interview without asking, because you've been in the business for so long and you're now a teacher. When your students leave your course, what's the one thing you hope they take away? Just the biggest piece of advice for them that they just know, like, right here when they walk out the door.
I think being accountable, you know, is the thing for me. And that says a lot of different things. So it's accountable to themselves, accountable to their businesses that they work for. Marry those two things together. Because if you're personally accountable for what you do, then you're going to take that into your business and be a good employee.
Oh, I like that.
You know, if you don't know something, say so. You know, like, I don't know.
You people know? Are afraid to do that.
They are.
They think, oh, I'm going to sound stupid if I ask. I don't.
Well, I think, and they don't understand that interpretation from chefs is everything. This is how I do this here. I don't care how you did this over here. I want you to do how I want to do it over here.
Communication.
Communication. Say, I don't, chef, can you show me? Please show me, and I'll make it happen every single time just like that.
Sure, sure.
You know, and be cool and upfront about it. Huh. If you're wrong, say you're wrong. You know, and that's it.
Oh my God, no kidding. You know, I mean, just say so. Yeah. Nobody, just say so and move on.
And, you know, and this is an unforgiving business. And, you know, you have to be realistic in your expectations. And, you know, there is a pot of, you can work hard and become very successful. You know, but, you know, like anything in life, you know, you're going to have to put effort into it. And you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to take it seriously and take yourself seriously. And, you know, and you
just, and be accountable.
And be accountable. Climb your way up just like any other job.
Yeah.
You know, because that's just the way it is. And the hours, too. I have to let them know, like, you're going to be working great, terrible hours. So
you will be very tired.
Yeah. Like, I saw this on this, I think, the guy Emeril, right? You know, like, talk about Emeril. They're like, see them in the Food Network. And I was like, that guy got there because he worked really hard.
Yeah.
You don't have to like him or his food or what he does or his catchphrases. But, you know, respect the fact that the dude made a brand out of himself. And it probably took a lot of work.
Yeah. No charge.
And be respectful to that. And so, and, you know, and the other thing is, I would say, is cook passionately with intensity and, you know, and try to use the best ingredients you can get your hands on every single time.
but that you can afford.
Right. Again, that balance, that bottom line.
Yeah. If you're, I mean, if your client base is this price point, mm-hmm. you have to sell to that because mm-hmm. you're being paid to do that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, get the best ingredients you can, because you can't make bad ingredients taste good.
Right.
You can't, you just can't, right. you know, they just suck. I mean, it's like, you know, bad beef is just bad beef, and it doesn't matter how awesome you are at your job. You're never going to taste, make it taste better than what it is.
Right. Maybe but you make can stew,
take, but you can take really good down. Beef and make it awful.
Right.
Do you know?
Easily. Cook it to death. Cook it yeah. well done.
And so many things I'm saying. I know you wanted one thing, but like, the other thing is like buy local. And realize that that steak is a story, and it's like feeds that guy's family, and you know, just burning it and throwing it in the trash can is a loser way of thinking about cooking, and you don't have respect for the people that provide food for you mm-hmm. and the amount of time. It means you don't care about your job.
Yeah. You respect know? The work they put into it.
Right.
Put
and,
in the same
it's
amount.
It's not okay to burn something.
Yeah.
It just isn't.
Yeah.
You know, and so you have to take that seriously. And that's be serious about yourself and what you do.
I want to do a round table about food waste, because I hear chefs bringing it up all the time.
We could go another hour. I had one trash can in Red Pump, and I watched yeah. everything that went in that trash can.
I'm going to be calling you when I do it, because I feel like we could talk a whole other hour about food waste.
Please. I mean, if you want to talk to me more, I'm glad. I hope I so. I hope I. I hope
I'll be part two.
Sure. I hope I gave you good information. And
that was all excellent advice. Thanks. Excellent advice. And I would love to take a class with you. I bet you're an amazing teacher.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It means a lot to me. And it means a lot that you thought of me here. You know, I don't often think of myself as having this forum, I guess, or being able yeah. to talk. Yeah. You well, know, I always thought it's reserved for people that have accolades, I guess, if you want to think of it like that. So I appreciate mm-hmm. you bringing this to me and allowing me to have a voice. So
oh,
thank
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. We talked before we turned the tape on, because you did a podcast with Craig, mm-hmm. his Chew the Fat, as I did. And it was so neat. That was probably 6 or 7 years ago. And it was so neat for me to listen to both of them, because it was almost like a little time capsule.
Do I sound different now than I did then?
You do.
Okay.
In a good way, in the right way.
Life,
you know, like life. Like
life is a teacher of yeah. values.
And that's what, like, coming here, I got mm-hmm. kind of a chill. I was like, wow, we both... It was just cool. It was really cool
well,
to
you.
Hear that little time snippet, like a little time capsule of sound. I have the link in the show notes, guys.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's very kind of you to say, Janae. I mean, that's very nice.
All right. How about some fun questions to end
Please,
up?
Please. Let's fire away.
All right. You mentioned pound cake and Nutella. Is that your secret junk food vice? Like, if you just had a shit day and you come home and you're like, God, I really need some.
I have to say that when I worked in a kitchen, like, consistently, like, I didn't eat very well. You know, I wanted pizza, and I wanted to come home and open up a can of soup and do that. So, like, my junk food intake was...
All the time.
Like, and, you know, you eat standing up in the kitchen, and so I didn't eat very well. And now, you know, I put on 20 pounds, and, you know, like, I feel a lot healthier now. So I have two very health-conscious women that live in my house right now. And so, like, now I'm eating lots of chicken, lots of fish. I haven't had red meat in a long time.
See, you have 20 pounds to put on. You're skinny.
Well, I did. I mean, I didn't eat at all. And, like, I just realized that I didn't ever eat.
That's another round table, because I hear a lot of chefs and their eating habits aren't the best.
They're not.
Yeah, because the hours they keep.
You know, my favorite junk food, I guess, is that's what you're...
Yeah, what's your... Like, maybe when Jackie's not around, you're like, well, I can sneak this while she's out.
Yeah, I mean, I have... Like, right now, it's bread. Because she's on the paleo diet, and, like, I'll get a couple pieces of pizza from Lilo's, which is a rebranded Christian's Pizza from Pantops. That guy, Christian's no longer affiliated with any of these restaurants, but you know, it's the guy up there. And so now when she comes home, I mean, I would come home from the school at night, and she would have like this, I am probably ratting myself out right now, but like she would have a wonderfully healthy meal ready. And I had went and stopped at Chick-fil-A and just crushed like two Chick-fil-A. So I'd say fast food and bread
Some
right now.
Some people hate chicken. That's what my friend Scotty
calls it. She does all right, get me stuff like
cake. And right now, well, if you want to, inside of my microwave, which doubles as my like snack food bin, is I've got like chocolate turtles and
God, those are good.
Chocolate right now is that. If I can pick one thing, I'd say chocolate and fast food.
No kidding. Yeah, I'm a cookout girl. I sneak cookout
God,
every.
I love Chick-fil-A. I'm not gonna lie to you. I just love it.
I'm going to tell on myself too. My friend Scott, he calls it hate chicken. Mm. And he said he's gay. He said, I give you permission to eat it if you get a lesbian to say it's all right too. So like one from each camp. So my cousin's best friend is a lesbian. So she said, oh girl, go on and eat it. It's fine. I eat it too, but shh.
Don't tell anybody.
Just don't tell anybody. It's not every day.
It's the spicy chicken sandwich. I don't know what it is. I mean, it's the pickle brine, I think. And
I support the LGBT.
Yeah, I do too.
But I eat the hate chicken. I'm sorry.
I'm very much not a fan of our president right now. So,
there's another hour.
But I will eat the chicken. Yeah. Okay, I'll do that. So.
Oh my goodness. We both admitted it on tape.
My dad is not happy with me right now, but that's okay. But that's my junk food, I think.
There you go. That's our secret junk food advice. Do you have a Botto's order when you're in town?
I do. I just had it on Sunday with my brother, actually. I have pastrami and Swiss on an everything bagel with onion, lettuce, and spicy mustard.
That's my order, except for the onion.
Love it.
Oh my God, the pastrami Swiss on everything.
Love that. And I get the bagel with the blueberry cream cheese on it.
Oh, I haven't had that.
You should.
I get the jalapeno lime is good.
It's good too. See, I like the, it's very savory bagel. And then I get a sweet spread on it and the contrast is pleasing to me. But
so that's on everything, the blueberry.
Yes.
No joke. Okay, I got to try that because that's weird.
The only thing they don't do is toast it, which I've never understood, but like
I get it. I don't get that either.
It is a good bagel.
It totally is. Mm-hmm. It totally is. If you could fly to any city right now for free just to eat, where would you go?
I would go to Chicago and eat at Grace, I think. I would fly to eat at Manresa, David Kinch's restaurant.
Yeah. Right? He's nuts.
We're
in a good way.
He is.
I saw a show about him and just, I was like, whoa.
He's on Mind of a Chef now, this last season, which is great.
That's what it is.
I really like his food a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of technique into it, but it's not fussy. So.
And a good dude.
Yeah, kind of chill. And, you know, I think that's a little probably done up for TV, but, you know, I'm sure there is no successful chef that's not a micromanager.
Right. You almost have to be.
Have to be. So. But he does. So probably those two places, I would say. I
expected him to be so different from how he is. I did a surfer, who's so laid back.
And it comes out in his food. His food looks very zen and kind of like, connected to himself and the environment that he's in.
So you've eaten there?
Haven't. I'd love to eat there.
Oh my God, me too. That's on a bucket list.
I'm lucky because Jacqueline's sister works for Jean-Georges Von Richten and is his human resources director. So we get to go in New York. We go a couple times a year, and she, I just ate at Labor in the summertime.
Oh.
Ate at Danielle this summer, man. And then we go out. So we frame the one places we go, and so
you do that too.
Yeah, and then. That's cool. But she can make, so I'm lucky in New York City, so I would probably go someplace other than New York to eat.
Yeah.
I ate at Roberta's last summer too, which was for me the best I've eaten at because I like the, that's another style of restaurant that I'd like to own. But if I ever could ever do anything as great as Roberta's,
is that pizza?
Pizza, and, food as well, like dining food. Yeah. I had a great dining experience there. It's awesome. Sometimes those are places that are overhyped. When you get there and you're a little, it's not a fine dining, coursed out atmosphere, mm-hmm. and you go to a place that's not like that, and mm-hmm. you feel like, but it's that one wasn't as, it was awesome.
All right, I got to ask this fun question because it just occurred to me. What's the best pizza you've ever had, being a pizza guy?
Mine?
Your own.
I made it to my tastes.
Yeah.
But I feel the best I've had, the style of pizza that I've wanted to emulate, I think Lauren's pizza is damn good.
Yeah, it is.
I really
good.
Do. Mine's evolved since Red Pup. So, you know, and a lot of it I've eaten at Lauren's a bit, and you know, I like it, and I think that I really like his. Just to plug, you know, give somebody props in my own town, you know. So I think they do a fine job there. Roberta's was great.
I just had a really good one at Mercado in Chapel Hill.
Oh, great. Okay.
And this guy, he's the son of the couple that owned Magnolia Grill.
Oh, right. Excellent. Yeah, yeah.
So he went and studied in San Francisco for a decade and came back and opened this place. And it blew me away.
What style pizza?
It's just a real, like, it's a thin crust. And he just does really, he did a carbonara pizza. Mm, yeah. Dude, oh my God. Like, I was dreaming about it.
Wood-fired?
Yeah.
And is it Neapolitan-style crust? Or
yeah.
Like sort of
a thin crust, like Neapolitan.
On the bottom, but has a nice cornice on the outside.
Yeah.
That's soft and crunchy at the same time?
Yeah.
Great. Love that. That's me, too. I'm very much a New Haven pizza-style person.
Yeah. Yeah. I had to ask that. Okay,
and I hope I didn't sound arrogant by saying mine, but
well,
like,
mine.
But I kind
of
I like
that. What that just means you need to open a place.
Well,
now.
No, but I cook it the way I like it.
Yeah.
So and that's why I think it's the best because that's my taste and how I like it. I don't think I'm not saying it's the best there is.
Right.
You know. But this is another thing I tell my students: what does the best mean to you? Because the best barbecue, the best pizza, you know, it's so subjective. And you know, and if you had asked me who's the best technically style of pizza made in the world, I would say, you know, Roberta's would be for me. I would say that's the style I'm looking to do. Frank Pepe's pizza. But, you know, for my palate and what I like to eat, you know, like I like the way I make it for myself. That's just, you know, so I only hope I could be as successful as Lauren or other people that are out there in the world. So
Yeah.
I had to clarify because I didn't want to seem like this big arrogant dude that thought I was like saying I was the shit or something like that, you know, like,
no, I totally got what you were saying.
Because
you have this image. Because I do. I'm such a snob with it. I have this image of what I want to taste, and I have to admit I'm disappointed a lot of the time.
Exactly, but that's. But I bet to the guy that grew up next door to that place, and you know, said, "Hey, this is the memory I have from my childhood. The pizza
it's
that
so
I like."
Subjective.
And you roll the best in there, like barbecue exchange. Like barbecue is like a point of contention all over the country.
Sure. Sure.
And they're going to say their local guy is better than everybody else in the country. And
absolutely.
And maybe on one given day, they're true.
Yeah.
But, you know, the next day somebody's made the best. And the next day somebody's made the best. And
that's why I stopped reviewing restaurants. Because I was like, I no. Because I'm just one opinion. All right. And this is the last. I always ask this question last. Because it's a community-centered podcast. And I like to pay it forward. Who in the food community should I interview next?
Well, Tucker, I think, would spring to mind simply because he was like, gave me a look when I said that you're interviewing me. So I think...
he did.
Well, I think he... I mean, I'm good friends with Tucker, and we, you know, I worked with him at Timber
Creek. What kind of a look?
Why hasn't she called me look? You know, kind of look, you know, so... And he's deservedly so, you know, Tucker's somebody I admire greatly.
Oh, and Tucker, 8 people have recommended you. I just have to get around to it.
Sure.
No, he's on the list.
And I think he's somebody I admire a lot about his cooking because A, he's awesome. B, he does it his way. He has his own style and he stays very true to that. 3, he doesn't care about making money. He cares about making things really good. And, you know, I think like when he starts talking about bread baking, a conversation him and I had recently about that, Tucker was like, you know, I'm not going to sell this bread. He's talking to Jerry. He's like, I want to make it better than anybody else's bread in Charlottesville, but I don't care about making, I just want to make the best loaf of bread.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, and you know, and
I have to admit, he intimidates me a little bit. Maybe that's why I haven't reached out yet.
He is a, don't worry. He's a,
well, cause I've met him a couple times and
very approachable guy. He's great. You know, I mean, he's opinionated and he has his own way of being, you know, he has his idea of what things
There's
are.
There's a couple chefs here that I'm like, okay, I know I need to talk to them, but I'm going to have to.
Who else are you intimidated by, Janae?
Tim Burgess, like the Bizu and Christian too, but I've heard
Christian Kelly?
Yeah.
You will find no more of a approachable, pleasant person, down to earth, great dude than Christian Kelly.
Do you know? You know, part of it.
I will call him right now when we're done and tell him to talk to you. So he would be honored to talk to you.
Do you know what it is? And I'm going to get vulnerable for a second.
Sure.
I still feel, I've been here 9 years, and I still feel a bit of a carpetbagger. Like, I'm not from here.
Everybody
you know, I'm
else
not,
isn't from here either, though.
Yeah.
Everybody,
it's that imposter syndrome.
I thought you were from here. So if that makes you, that's why I was asking about where you came from. So you don't, I think it's, I think anybody that has a forum to talk about themselves in a positive way should be, you know,
okay,
good for that. I think you're a good avenue for that, Janae. So
it's like, how long do I live here before I fit in? You know, it's that little voice in the back of your head.
Without being too presumptuous, I think that, I think Christian Kelly would tell you a way, because he opened up his business and runs his life so that he could be a better husband, a better father, a better person, and still put really great food out and run a good business.
Yeah.
And he's got a lot of really good perspective. And I admire that about him, because he's got his shit together.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, he's had to work his life too. And, you know, so he'd be a great person for you to talk to. And he's not like that at all.
I will.
Everybody just thinks he's so handsome. So it's like, they're like, wow, he's a handsome dude. So like,
maybe that's why.
Is that it?
Like,
you know, so
I'll have hearts in my eyes the whole time.
No, he's good. He's taught me a lot. So I can certainly, if you're interested, I can
yeah,
give him a call.
Yeah, no, totally. And Tucker, too.
So another person I would say, since that's, we'll get a third. I think, have you spoken to Justin Hershey?
Oh, I have to, because he's got his Chicano boy going. And oh, I love
probably
him.
Probably the best technically proficient chef that I've ever worked with.
Oh, I loved him at Zinc. So, oh, dude.
And he's smart. Yeah. His food's great. He's creative.
And funny as shit.
Funny, and he's got a bit of an attitude, a bit. So, in a good way. So,
oh, he cracks me up.
Yeah, and he's a confident guy. So, I think he's going to be for you, too.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Definitely.
Sorry, my dog's going off again.
she's gonna take us out here. Another truck just came by.
Sorry, people.
Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for letting me blather on and on. I appreciate that.
This podcast will be the start of my third year in recording, and what a great start.
Thank you so much. And you know, like, I've had a great time as well, and it's been an honor. And you know, anytime you feel like listening to me, if you need more, feel free to get in touch with me and we'll talk more. So
Appreciate
that. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you.
My pleasure.
Guys, I apologize for the UFO sounds there towards the end of the interview. Not sure what that was, and I wasn't sure how to get rid of it without ruining our conversation. So again, I apologize. I did have a microphone die shortly after this podcast. Maybe we talked it to death. So maybe that's what it was. Wasn't that fucking amazing? Okay, yeah, I don't like to cuss a lot, but I walked out of that interview and it was a gorgeous warm day in January. You know, something so rare. And I just felt so tingly and warm and wonderful. I was like, yeah, that's so much honesty. Like, we really got to it. And success is something that I have struggled with so much, and defining it for myself has been such a challenge. But every time I do, it's like another notch in the belt. You feel like you've passed another border or crossed another border or maybe stepped up another step or stepped off the ledge into groundlessness. It's scary, but it feels really great when you do it. Thanks, Todd, for that conversation. And thank you for being here today. Today's show is sponsored by Teej FM, TEEJ FM. It's a community collaborative podcast network created by WTJU. Learn more at teej.fm. We are also sponsored by Patreon and listeners like you who put forth $1 a month. As little as $1 a month. Wow, I sound like Sarah McLachlan. Learn more at patreon.com/audaciouspod. And actually, rather than sponsoring me, I would much rather that you dedicate your hard-earned money to the Scotty Nichols Cancer Fund, if you can. And if you can't, share, because Facebook only puts forth posts to maybe 3% of your friends, maybe 6% of your friends. So even one share can increase the reach exponentially. Thanks for being here today, guys. You can find me at iTunes. The website is audacious.co because .com is still for sale. Send me your comments. Submit a review. Do you have suggestions for future guests or topics, places I should visit? Let me know. And until next time, I am Janae Libby of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. I'm ferocious, I'm very loquacious, and when it comes to learning about food and keeping those community connections going, I'm audacious, and I hope you are too. Cheers.